We're continuing this week with interviews recorded at the Kivira Coalition Conference that happened in Albuquerque in mid-November. The Kivira Coalition is on the web at kiviracoalition.org. I'd like now to welcome Tom Sidwell. He's a rancher who lives south of Tucumcari, New Mexico. He practices holistic ranching. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So your ranching practices are very interesting. They're showing us that by improving the land, conserving water, doing erosion control, basically thinking like a conservationist, you are actually doing a model that's more economically successful as a rancher here in the Southwest. How did you develop these ranching practices?
I first learned about holistic management from Alan Savory in 1980. And that's when I first went to one of his courses and have repeated these courses several times since then. And at the time, I worked for the Bureau of Land Management in Socorro, New Mexico, and also had a small farming operation in which I started implementing some of the holistic management principles, and eventually resigned from BLM and started managing some ranches for other folks based on those holistic management principles.
So you find yourself doing things like actually planning for drought and planning grazing rather than reacting when big changes happen.
Exactly. The basic concept is just like a herd of buffalo, the way the buffalo grazed naturally, or the wildebeest in Africa. They would graze in large herds. Their feet had a tremendous impact on the soil surface and on the grass, standing grasses. And then they would move and graze a short period of time and then move to another area. And so those areas that were grazed had sufficient time to recover. And so water and vegetation and the animals all evolved in a coexistent manner. So that's what we try to simulate.
And so how do you do that?
First of all, you want to run one herd of cattle. Most ranchers will run several herds of cattle. When you have a small herd in a pasture and they're there for a long period of time, that's completely counter to how Mother Nature had evolved. So you want to run one herd of cattle.
Now, how big is, what's the limit on the size of a herd?
There's no limit.
Oh, okay.
There's no limit. I've had as many as 1,800 cows in one herd. So it's, there's no limit.
Just as
the bigger, the better.
I suppose there can be huge herds of bison in
exactly.
Nature as well.
Hundreds of thousands. There's historical reports of a million. You know, it's just, they couldn't count them all.
Right.
But, and so in order to run one herd of cattle like that, then you have to have the water, develop the water resources in order to run that one herd of cattle. So over a period of time and through planning, we do land planning. You can subdivide the acreage into pastures, plan for your water developments, and especially if you have water development completed, then you can begin to manage your cattle in one herd and then rotate them through the various pastures. You know, as an example, we had 8 pastures when we started. Average grazing period was 14 days, and now we have 25 pastures and average grazing period is 4 days.
And so the pastures rest for many times longer than they're grazed.
Absolutely. And when we do the grazing planning, well, then we start with the length of grazing of rest period that you want. And so I use a 105-day rest period.
Now, that's specific to the Southwest, to New Mexico?
Oh, well, yeah, it would be. The higher the rainfall, the shorter the rest period that you can have, simply because you have more rainfall and the grass recovers quicker and so on and so forth. I'm toying with the idea of perhaps going to a 130-day rest period. So by doing that, I graze each pasture 1 day longer, but they'll rest 25 days, have a 25-day longer rest period. So that's something that I may start doing in the next year or so.
Now, does it make it easier to move cattle when you have multiple pastures like that?
It's very easy. And, in fact, the cattle will anticipate the moves. And many ranchers can be fooled by that. The cattle are anticipating the move because the pasture they're going into is fresher. The grass is more lush and it's fresher. You don't have the dust and
the grass is greener on the other side of the fence.
Exactly, exactly. So the cattle will actually fool a lot of ranchers into making them move them earlier. So if you move them too early, well, then you end up having shorter rest periods. And if the rest period is too short, then the grass doesn't recover sufficiently from one grazing period to the other grazing period. So you got to be very careful. But the cattle, once they get into that mindset of rotation, and they learn right away that you can, you know, if you stimulate them with a whistle, or I use just my voice as a cow call, when they hear that, they know they're going to fresh groceries. So they'll come to you. They'll come to that gate and move themselves.
Now, here we are in a time of drought, and drought that's exacerbated by climate change. And as we've seen, drought not only dries up the grass that the cattle eat, but it also changes the vegetation. What are some of those changes that happen during drought periods?
Well, you know, we'll get a change in the grass component, the grass species. We've seen that. We also see more invasive brush species become established. And those species are better able to cope with drought because they send down a taproot, and they can get that deep moisture better than a grass root can. And so, you know, you look at some old photographs, old historical photographs, and you can see where the brush has invaded after a drought, after nearly drought. Every drought, you see the brush invasion. And, of course, we've eliminated the fire, and that's a natural part of the ecosystem, and we've eliminated that, basically. And so what used to control brush invasion in the past, we no longer have that control.
I mean, it's interesting. We've talked quite a lot on this program about forest management, and now there's controlled burns and letting certain forests burn and so on. How does that come into play on a ranch?
You know, my experience with controlled burns, first of all, a lot of them are at the wrong time of the year from when nature did the natural burn. Just like driving down to Harris Canyon yesterday, well, there's a sign there that says controlled burn. This is November. We haven't had any lightning strikes. You usually don't have lightning strikes in November. And so it's not a natural time of the year for a burn to really be effective. They're just not hot enough, and you need a hot fire to control the brush. And so when you do get your majority of your lightning strikes, it's when you have thunderstorms come up, June, July, it's really hot in June, wind is blowing, you have a dry lightning strike, starts a big fire, and no rain. But Mother Nature did it that way. And we just put those fires out, and then, you know, we have the problems that we have today. And the interesting thing, my father grew up at the base of the Captain Mountains in the south central part of the state, and at the turn of the century. And I asked him one time if there were a lot of fires on Captain Mountain. He said, oh, yeah. He said, it burned all the time. And he said, but the fires were low-intensity fires. They didn't burn hot. He said they would burn for maybe months at a time. Nobody ever paid attention to them. Then when the rainy season came, the rain had put them out. And so, consequently, you had open forests instead of a thick understory.
We're talking to rancher Tom Sidwell. One of the things that is very interesting when you present the work that you do, as you have done recently at the Kivira Coalition Conference, you show fence lines with, on one side is your ranch, on the other side is your neighbor. And the difference is so striking. It's more green, it's more lush. The snow somehow goes down to the earth better and doesn't sit on top. I don't know how you do that, but doesn't sit on top of the grass. And basically, you have these practices that you're talking about make for a much lusher vegetation, even in these drought years. Do your neighbors come to you and say, hey?
Well, a lot of the, they do notice, but I've had several of them tell me, yeah, said, well, it rains more up there. And I said, yeah, I said, that rain cloud just follows the fence line all the way around. I've never seen anything like it before. So I answered in a sarcastic kind of a way. I don't know. I've spent 30-something years trying to figure out why other ranchers can't see this, why they can't ask questions and say, you know, this works. Maybe I need to be trying something like this.
Well, that's what I was wondering. And they don't do that?
They don't. No, they don't. And I've quit trying to figure it out. I don't know. There's a real adversity to change. Ranching business is very tradition-bound. So I think a lot of people, well, Dad did it this way, so this is how I'm going to do it. And they just won't change. And so I don't worry about it. I mean, I don't know how you get them to change.
I would have thought you would have a consulting business and a teaching practice and all sorts of things when people would see not only that it's working, but that you've got positive cash flow.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. I don't know.
Yeah. Very interesting. So in addition to, I mean, we're talking about moving the herds, we're talking about water management, we're talking about taking out the non-native brush like mesquite and so on. You also have an awareness of wildlife in the watershed. How are you working to protect both of those?
The watershed, you know, first of all, with the brush control, we're eliminating that plant that intercepts the rainfall and then using a large percentage of it. So when you eliminate that, then more water is available for the land, for growing vegetation, and for recharging the aquifers. I also will use the brush that I clear for stopping erosions, gullies, things like that, and getting some sediment built up back into those arroyos.
So you'll clear the brush and then put it in gullies?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where there's a gully available, you know, I'm not going to push it very far, but yeah, where there's anything available, I push it into the gullies. And you know, I've seen where we'd have 5 feet of silt that built up in 1 year's time.
And what does that do?
Well, that slows the water down. And then it has a greater water holding capacity. And when you have a straight-sided arroyo, then that drains the adjacent land. So you're dropping the water table in that adjacent land. So when you can fill that arroyo, and it's still a drainage, but it's a shallow, sloped drainage, and water is running slow down it, then you're building that water table back up into the adjacent, what used to be the adjacent banks. And we've seen one of our wells increase from 1/4 gallon a minute to 1.25 a minute. That's a huge
amazing
increase.
Yeah, that it's a fivefold increase.
Yeah.
Just through, like, taking out mesquite trees and putting them in the gully?
The juniper trees, mm-hmm. Primarily juniper trees. And then with the grazing planting, you also allow the grasses to grow. And as the grasses grow, they intercept the rainfall, slow that impact on the ground. And instead of the water just running off like this table, the grass holds it up and allows it to soak in. And so you effectively improve your precipitation. We're not going to get any more rain, but we can increase the effective precipitation that we do receive.
Right.
And so that's basically what we're doing. And I've seen, on other ranches where I've seen some old springs come back that have been dry for 80 years. And I've seen other wells that have increased their water levels. And so you improve the grass. The grass becomes healthy, and then your soil becomes healthy, and your water table becomes healthy, and it just builds up, you know, just builds one after the other.
And so you're effectively, by doing those things, you're increasing rainfall, even without getting the new rain.
Right, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that I also found interesting was that, I mean, there's other side benefits to this. You did some of this clearing away of non-native species with the help of, what was it, the Wild Turkey Foundation?
National Wild Turkey Foundation,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Why did they have any interest in helping you?
We have some turkeys, and the population is very, it's in trouble. They know that the habitat is not good, the present habitat. So through grant funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, well, then they offer these contracts. Basically, they pay for 3/4 of the cost of doing the work, and then the landowner will pay the other 25%. And so I have my own equipment, so I do all the work myself. And it's a way to improve the land that I was going to do anyway. It's just that now it makes it more affordable.
And there's wild turkeys there.
We have wild turkeys, and we've really had some problems with trying to get the population up. And we have, we went from 13 to 75, and then now we're back down to 10 or something like that. But a lot of them have moved out other places. But in the last 3 years, we haven't seen any poult survival, young chick survival. And it has a lot to do with the weather at the time they lay their nest. The last 3 years, we've had a cold spell.
Right.
And that will freeze the eggs if they ever get off the nest. So.
Now, once you clear out brush, you clear out non-native species, you clear out juniper and mesquite and so on, do they come back? Is it a kind of ongoing battle against them, or do other species kind of take over?
The mesquite can come back. There's a lot of beans on the ground, and so it can come back. Now, we do get a tremendous increase in grass where that mesquite plant had been, and sometimes I don't get all of the taproot out, so it'll come back from that taproot. But generally, I would say when I grub it, we'll get 95% of it cleared. And then whatever comes back or whatever I miss, there's little small plants that you don't see. I'll go back and I'll get them with a chemical or something like that later, see. Just hand control. So that's a very small amount of cleanup or follow-up that we have to do, but you need to do it. It's just like any other range improvement project. It takes maintenance.
Right.
And now the juniper, we don't see that coming back like the mesquite. Over time, you will get some of those berries that will germinate and they'll come back. But at that time, I hope to be able to use fire, perhaps, to control them, because they'll be of a size, a small size, that fire will easily control them. And we'll get back to the way Mother Nature did it.
What you're doing, essentially, is restoring the land to the kind of grassland that it was, 100, 150 years ago?
Yeah, even 60 years ago, or 70 years ago, yes. My neighbor has a photograph that his father, who was a World War I pilot, took from the airplane of their house and hangar and landing strip, and our ranch was in the background. And this photo was in 1946. And there wasn't any brush. It's amazing. No cactus, no choya cactus.
Yeah.
So it's very amazing. So I think a lot of what we have today probably got started in the 50s drought and then has just increased and gotten worse. So.
You have talked about grazing planning and drought planning and brush control, and the other part of your model for having a successful and sustainable and ecologically sound ranch is adding value. How do you add value?
Well, as an example, traditionally, the calves are sold in the fall of the year, and everybody sells their calves in the fall of the year, so the market prices are usually lower. It's simple supply and demand. And in the spring, then prices go up because there's less supply. And so by being able to, first of all, grow the grass through grazing planning, and then to be able to allocate that forage and plan for a drought, we are able to have the grass to hold our weaned calves over until the following spring. And so we take advantage of that higher market in the spring like that. And then we've gotten into the grass-fed business.
And that means you don't use hay?
We don't use hay. The only time we'll feed any hay at all is if we get several inches of snow and it covers the grass. We'll feed hay because the cattle need that energy to keep from losing weight, first of all, to come through that bad storm in good shape. So it may only be 1 or 2 days at a time that we feed hay. And, you know, it's very little hay that we feed. But, like I say, the only time we'll feed it is when they don't have access to the grass because of the deeper snow.
Yeah.
And the grass-fed beef, then we're able to add an additional value by growing them out to 16, 17 months of age, taking them to slaughter, and then we sell to retail cuts to a lot of customers. We'll sell quarters, halves, and wholes to other customers, and that adds quite a lot of value to the animal.
Because grass-fed beef is very desirable for...
Very popular.
Yeah.
And it's been a niche market, but it's a growing market now. A lot of people are dissatisfied with the meat they get in the grocery store. I won't eat it out of the grocery store. It's horrible. But a lot of people do, and that, I don't think they really realize what they're getting. But, I mean, that is part of the industry business, too. So, like I say, it's a niche market, and we just take advantage of that niche market. We're supplying a product for that niche market.
Are your customers all individuals? Do you also sell to stores, farmers markets?
No, they're all individuals. We've had several restaurants contact us. The problem there is that they just want certain cuts, and they want maybe these cuts every week. And so then you're left with a whole lot of roasts and hamburger and things like that that you've got to be able to market somewhere else. We just haven't been able to balance that out.
Right.
But with our customer base, there's no need to sell to the restaurants. We just we don't need to do that.
We're talking to rancher Tom Sidwell. So you've been doing this now for many decades. You were managing other people's ranches, then you bought your own ranch. Mm-hmm. How do you see this movement growing and spreading? I mean, you were saying your neighbors weren't interested. I mean, what's happening?
There's certainly a lot more awareness of it out there. I can count on one hand the number of practitioners that I started with. I'm probably the longest practicing practitioner in New Mexico, but there's some that are just a couple of years behind me. And they're still in business. They're doing great. There's younger folks out there that have shown a lot of interest in the holistic management. I see more awareness. I'm not sure how much more is being put on the ground. But I do see a lot more awareness of it. You see it in magazine articles, people that win awards that are awarded, you know, stewardship awards. They're practicing holistic management, whereas a few years ago that wasn't the case. So you see more and more of that, and I think as a general rule, well, then it's growing, but it's growing very slowly.
There are so many different ways of looking at the land. There's the indigenous way of thinking where the land is sacred. There's a kind of environmentalist conservationist perspective where the land is beautiful and it's an ecosystem that has its own integrity that's important to preserve so that it's not ruined. There's the economic perspective, which is you use the land to make money and sustain yourself. And it seems like the kind of ranching that you're doing, it's possible both to have a deep land ethic and economic success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I have been involved in the ranching business, you know, all my life, and could never afford a ranch when I got out of college. I went to work for Bureau of Land Management and you know, started acquiring a little farming operation and things like that. And it wasn't until many years later that we were able to acquire our own ranch. But the thing about it is that with the grazing planning, with the land planning and financial planning, there's a very, very intensive, detailed financial planning, that you can make a ranch work. The first 3 years we were, after buying this ranch, we took cattle in on pasture. And so that way you're not borrowing money to buy cattle, not paying high interest rates. It's instant cash flow. You get paid every month. and take care of somebody's cattle. And so it's a way of making a living while at the same time building up the infrastructure that you need on the ranch to go that extra step. And we've done that on a couple of different ranches, just take somebody else's cattle on pasture. And it works. If a young person can lease a ranch and then take cattle in on pasture, his capital outlay is very, very low. But it's, at the same time, very difficult to find ranches to lease, you know, for a young couple or a young person. But it can be done, and it can be quite profitable that way, to where you can start building equity.
So do you feel like there is a kind of land ethic in your work?
I have a very strong land ethic. I'm not a preservationist. I don't agree with the radical environmentalist agenda, but I believe land can be very well taken care of and improved while at the same time generating income, and that generates more income. You have the multiplier effect throughout the economy, local economy. It's a way to keep the ranchers on the ground. We're losing a lot of ranchers. We don't see young people coming back. To me, every place that I've either managed for somebody else or a ranch that we've bought, when I left that ranch, it was in better shape than when we came there. And that's just a point of principle for me. I want to leave it in better shape than when I first came there. This ranch we have is very evident of that. I learned a lot from my father. He was an old-time cowboy back in the 1920s and 30s. And they did things different back then. But I learned a lot from him on conservation matters, you know, or techniques, things like that. So I guess it just comes naturally.
Tom Sidwell is a rancher who lives south of Tucumcari. He practices holistic ranching. If people want to find out more about your ranch, do you have a website?
We have a couple of different websites. We used to do some working ranch vacation. Did that for 13 years. And that was jxranch.com. And it's still ongoing. We don't do the guest ranching anymore. LeanNaturalBeef.com is our website for the grass-fed beef. But LeanNaturalBeef.com. And so there'll be a lot of pictures in there, and then some topics on holistic management also.
Well, Tom Sidwell, thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.